Welcome to the July 7th meeting, 2020 meeting of the Tompkins County Legislature. Would you please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag? I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you very much. Roll call of members.
Rich John. Anna Pellis. Dan Klein.
Here.
Ann Corman.
Present.
Mike Lane.
Here.
Dave McKenna.
I am here.
Glenn Morey. Martha Robertson.
Here.
Mike Sigler has asked to be excused. Shauna Black.
Here.
Amanda Champion.
Here.
Deborah Dawson.
Here.
Henry Grandison.
Present.
Leslie McBean Clairborn.
Present.
We have 10 members present.
Kathy, I'm here as well.
Chris John.
Okay, thank you, Rich. Glenn Morey. Glenn Morey's there. Anna Pellis.
I'm here as well.
Okay. It's 13 members present.
Thank you very much. There are no proclamations today. Other communications you would have already received. I don't believe there's any executive sessions for this evening. Right, Jason? Anyone? No, no executive session. And so I'm going to no special orders, no presentations today. I'm going to move on to privilege of the floor for the public. And we just received a message from Robert Lynch, Councilperson, Town of Enfield. The subject is reconsideration of Resolution 9367. And I will read it, as we had promised we'll read these things into the record. Dear Chair McBean Clairborn and the legislature, as a private citizen, a member of the Enfield Town Board, and an Enfield representative on the Tompkins County Council of Government, TCOG, I respectfully request your legislature reconsider and reconsiders on the line at tonight's meeting, resolution number 9367, rejected in a tie vote by your body June 16. Resolution 9367 would set in motion procedures for a speedier decennial reapportionment of your legislature, enabling voters to decide this November whether the next legislature term commencing in January 2022 would be shorter, allowing redistricting to take place sooner. To reconsider the measure, at least one of those who dissented last month, either legislators, and you know who you are, would need to raise the issue. I hope one does. Waiting until January 2026 for a properly apportioned legislature delays democracy for too long. One person, one vote is the law of the land. We should honor that principle in a timely manner. The Tompkins County Council of Governments on June 26 unanimously recommended that Resolution 9367 be reconsidered. At the meeting, Legislator Robertson revealed that your colleague, Mike Lane, will propose weighted voting for this body should timely redistricting not occur. Weighted voting was tried once. It proved cumbersome and inequitable. But as Lane told me, and this is in quotes, it is superior to having districts continue for another 5 years being under or overrepresented. Let's avoid voting by, end of quotes. Let's avoid voting by calculator. Let's use a better, fairer method, namely proper reapportionment. Several alternatives stand before you. I'll let you decide which option you prefer. Just don't choose to do nothing. As legislator Robertson said at TCOG, waiting 5 years is way too long to be out of whack with the population, and that's in quotes. Legislators Horman, McKenna, Sigler, Morey, Granison, Champion, or Black, will someone please step up to the plate? Please do. Respectfully submitted, Robert A. Lynch, Councilperson, Town of Enfield. That is the only correspondence we received on the privilege of the floor for the public. I am going to move on to municipal officials. Who's here? George. Hi. George McGonigal, City of Ithaca Common Council, First Ward Rep.
Good evening. Can you hear me?
Yes. Good evening, George, and welcome.
Thank you. I meant to get my audio on the telephone because it doesn't freeze as much, and I couldn't figure that out, so if I freeze, let me know, please.
Yes, sir.
I just want to tell you where we're at financially. We had a thorough comptroller's report at our meeting last week, and so far this year we're down two months of the year were very good. So we're down 14% in sales tax. We're down about $2 million from what we had projected. We furloughed 86 or 87 employees, and that saved us so far about $500,000. We have returned to work 23, maybe 25 employees. Four of them work at GIAC and are coming back largely around the reopening of the Alex Haley Pool. So we're very happy about that, and we're very thankful for not only Purity Ice Cream and the other group whose name I always forget.
Legacy
Foundation. Thank you, Leslin. But also, and those are great contributions of $80,000 to $90,000 total. But also, $8,000 was raised by just average citizens, so I want to thank them as well, even though we don't know their names. Speaking of the Alex Haley Pool, a group who put together the park and the little mini park and bench at the side of the house where Alex Haley was born on Cascadilla Street have gotten together again, and they've received a historic marker for the house. And I think it's going to be placed before his birthday this year, which would be his 99th birthday. And then next year on his 100th birthday, we'll have a real celebration. So that's something to look forward to. There's been at least 5 rope rescues by Ithaca Fire Department at the 30-foot dam so far this year. A number of people have gotten hurt jumping into the 6 Mile Creek from high places, and we would like to discourage that. It's dangerous, not only for the people who are doing it, but also for the people who are pulling them out. So please stop jumping off a 30-foot dam. That's all I've got.
Thank you, George. Any questions for George? I see Mike Lane and Henry Granison and Rich John. Mike Lane?
Hi, George. What you just reported about the dam incidents are very distressing. We used to have people that went out there and tried to encourage folks to behave by the rules out in the area. Are those officers still out there? They were, I forgot what we called them, but at one point the county actually supported some of those folks, and the city did as well. I think they went away, but I'm not sure. Can you tell me what's going on with them?
Yeah, they were called Gorge Rangers.
Rangers, that's right.
And the county did help contribute to their salary, and I think they are not out there now. There are no Gorge Rangers for financial reasons. And Giles Street on the sidewalk, it makes it very dangerous for pedestrians to walk on Giles Street because there's the sidewalk is blocked with cars. So we have been trying to enforce that some, but the city's shorthanded and it's 95 degrees out and people go there.
So we'd have to see those successful Rangers again.
But repeat that, Mike?
I just said it would be nice to see the Rangers again.
Oh. Thank you. Thanks, Mike. Henry, and then Rich?
Yes. Hi, George.
Hi, Henry.
I noticed the increase in the people getting hurt from First Dam and Second Dam. Have you guys thought about anything else that you can try in terms of getting people not to jump?
Not to my knowledge. We have not.
Is there a committee that it would come under?
Well, I suppose we could talk about it. We can urge the police officers to spend more time up there. That's the only solution I can think of. And as you know, we're short-staffed.
Yes. Okay, thanks.
Yep, sorry.
Thank you, George. No. No, it's really a struggle to, I mean, every year people are getting hurt and they still continue to do it. So I don't know what the next move is. And, you know, we don't want officers arresting people for protecting their own lives. Just got to keep pushing the word out that it's not safe. Rich?
Thank you, Leslyn. Last meeting, George Duxon came. We were talking about a press release that came out of the city about youth services and all the cuts that had happened. I had a conversation with your colleague Deb Mollenhoff today, and she indicated that more announcements are coming shortly, that a lot of the programming is coming back, and I wanted to say congratulations on the hard work and getting stuff going for the youth in the community. It sounds like it's much better news. So, thank you.
I think you know more than I do because I had not heard that yet.
Thank you, Rich. Thanks, George. Anna, then Shauna.
That was actually one of my questions, so thank you, Rich. And I was curious. I know another, you know, I we're in a difficult spot because it's also, you know, one of the hottest times of the year. So people certainly want to go swimming in any place and time and way that they can. So I understand the difficulty. One of the places that people go swimming a lot is East Shore. And I'm wondering if there's been any talk about that, because in the past, when it gets really crowded, the cars park on Route 34 and it gets really dangerous. Has there been any thought of coordinating, and actually this might be for Dwight as well, acknowledging that people are swimming there? It's not something that we condone or are opposed to per se, I don't think. And is there a possibility of transit, maybe even bus service there? It's not the easiest place to bike to either, so people take cars even if they can bike to it. Because of the shoulders, they're really not safe. So just curious if there's any coordination.
Is that a question for me?
It's a question for you, whether or not it's come up in conversation and it's something the city is trying to protect or prevent people from swimming there.
That's in the town, I believe, so city hasn't talked about it at all.
Oh, right. It's an 8th mile over the line, right.
Well, it hasn't come up in conversation.
Dwight, is that something that has been discussed for transportation?
No.
Hasn't come up. Thank you. Shauna?
Perhaps I take a different approach from this than the enforcement approach, but is there a way to make these areas safer? Because I know that there's Monkey Run, there's, you know, the Gorges, there's Lakefront, and, you know, we're not seeing the same call for emergency vehicles and emergency staff to staff these places as we are this specific location. And it's hot, and people want to be around water, and Cass Park Pool, which is a go-to for many of us, is closed this year. And so I think, you know, we need to have the real conversation about, like, how can we help people cool down, you know, and make it safe? And so, you know, I don't know. That's just my two cents, George.
Well, that's a good way to look at it. I do know there's a dilapidated old stone building with the 30-foot dam that people jump off, and that should be torn down. It's just stone cold, ought to be torn down, and maybe even fenced off. I mean, what makes it dangerous in the city is there's all these cliffs.
Yeah.
And when you're 18 years old, if you want to impress somebody, you jump off the cliff. I'd never had the stones to do that myself.
But you don't have to jump off the cliff to be able to enjoy the water.
That's true.
Exactly.
But if you want to impress your sweetie, you might want to jump off the cliff.
And so we do want to encourage people, Shauna, to enjoy the waterways. We have lots of gorges. We have lots of beautiful waterways. But, you know, you don't have to jump off the cliff to be able to enjoy it. That is really dangerous.
That's true. And maybe the answer is to somehow have lifeguards at the favorite swimming holes. I don't know. Of course, that would cost money.
Indeed. Indeed. Henry?
Yes, George, I know that in terms of your budget, you had that survey that you had out. I'd like to know about that. I'd also like to know about what are you guys going to be doing in terms of your 2020 budget? How are you going to be able to balance that?
You're trying to get some inside information, Henry?
Yes, I wanted some inside information.
That's a good laugh, George. Go ahead.
We're good.
You froze?
Pardon me?
You froze for a second there, George.
Yeah, I did that on purpose, because I don't really have an answer. Well,
how'd the survey work out?
The survey's not done. I mean, well, it is done, but we haven't compilated it yet. We're going to look at that at city administration. There's a lot of talk. But the survey is not really, a solid survey. It's based on internet, and it's going to be helpful, but it's not completely valid, I wouldn't say.
Right.
As far as the budget, it's going to tell us a lot about how fast sales tax revenues increase, and you know, parking took a huge hit. So we'll see.
Okay.
Sorry, Henry, no insider trade, no inside information for you.
Martha.
Thank you. Hey, George. All the talk about swimming makes me realize that, and this is maybe a for Jason and Frank as well. We, in the really hot days, we've encouraged people to go to the library or the mall for air-conditioned spaces that they can cool off in. A lot of people who just really have no other way to cool off. We don't have the library in the mall at this point. Is there anything that we can do to address this? I don't know.
That's a really good point, especially for older people.
Right.
To be honest, I haven't thought about that, but I think we should think about that.
All right. Well, I guess we can have the conversation too, but maybe you can take that back.
I will. Thank you for bringing that up.
Totally. Thanks, George.
All right. Annie?
Thank you. So I was having little trouble hearing you there, but I was just wondering, did you discuss anything about the conference center?
No, although the planning board has been hearing from the developers of Herald Square, and Herald Square is worried about the conference center building affecting how they can rent their property, and I think the planning board is taking those objections seriously, so that there may be some changes here. I'm not on the planning board, but the distance between the proposed casino building with the conference center and the back of the commons, the Herald Square building, and City Hall is pretty tiny, and that may be adjusted. In terms of paying for the conference center, I have no new information.
And I'll just rephrase my question, which you did answer, but I was just also not just asking about the conference center, but also because there's going to be a great deal of affordable housing. At least that was what was planned initially over the conference center. So thank you for answering, giving us an update.
All right, Martha, you have the last question before we let George go.
Yeah, you just made me wonder about, is this anything new about the conference center design and Herald Square? Is there something new about the space behind there?
I think Casino adjusted the space between the two buildings very slightly so that there would be more room between the two. But it's my understanding, and I'm not the final say by any means. It's my understanding that Herald Square is very unhappy, and with not only with the space between the two buildings, but with the amount of parking that will be available, and they feel that it will be difficult or impossible to rent their office space without more parking.
All right. Thank you very much, George. Thanks for joining us today. Thanks, everyone, for your questions.
Thank you.
Suggestions. All right. We're going to move along.
Have a good night, George.
Good night.
George, you don't have to leave.
No, I'm going to spy on you guys for a while.
Please do. Get some inside information. And Henry's trying to get out of you. Get some other legislature. Finisher the floor for the legislature.
Henry, how we can balance the budget.
We're not going to tell you how we're planning to balance our budget.
Try deciphering what's going on, George. Criminals on the floor for legislators. Anyone has anything they want to report on? Nobody's having any barbecues and parties in their districts. People are being safe. I'm so happy for that. Yay. All right. Thank you all very much. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Go ahead, Martha.
Thanks, Leslin. First, I wanted to just congratulate the candidates in the election that I want to say Tuesday, but it was like for weeks before Tuesday as well. These were several hard-fought and really important races. I think a lot of important issues were raised. So congratulations to our own Anna Kellis for the nomination of the Democratic Party for the New York State Assembly seat. Congratulations to Matt Van Houten. I believe this primary is the final election for the district attorney and to Seth Peacock, our city judge. So I was just looking at numbers, and we had something like 9,100 absentee votes come in out of just under 14,000. So more than half absentee ballots, and it'll be interesting to see to hear from Stephen and Elizabeth about what that means for the fall, so and how that went. That's just one thing. And I want to congratulate the voters for paying attention and for taking time and putting in the interest while so much else is going on. I want to mention something that's happening at the IDA tomorrow. The IDA has been talking off and on for a while about an affordable housing policy. The city had asked the IDA to consider putting in a requirement for any IDA projects that include housing, that they would have to include a percentage of affordable units. So recently, the Housing Committee met and has now proposed a policy that the IDA will vote on tomorrow at 2:30. Policy is that any housing developer that is interested in IDA abatements for housing will be required to pay $5,000 per unit of housing that they're putting in. And that would be payable at the time of the closing on the IDA application. The money would go to the Community Housing Development Fund, which has a proven track record of more than 10 years of actually leveraging millions and millions of dollars for affordable housing projects. So this will be another source of local money that will be really well used and much needed and well used for affordable housing here. The developer would have, there's an alternative, the developer would be exempt from that $5,000 per unit if they are actually providing at least 20% affordable units in their project for at least 20 years, and the level of funding would be to support for renters of less than 80% area median income. So there are a lot of projects that qualify in that kind of bucket. Those are usually the low-income tax credit projects. But for others that are basically private developers putting in housing in our community, this would be a one-time payment that goes to the housing fund. So I just wanted to let people know that that was happening. If anybody wants to make comments on that, they can write to Ina Arthur and public comment by 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, and the meeting is live streamed tomorrow at 2:30. So I'm feeling that it was a good compromise. I'm pleased that we finally got this to the table, and look forward to seeing how it works out, and hope that it brings a good amount of money to the community housing fund.
Thank you, Martha. Thanks for sharing that. And the IDA meeting is tomorrow at
2:30, and it'll be live streamed. I can send the agenda packet, which has the information, out to everybody if there's interest.
Thank you. Anna?
Yeah, I just I wanted to acknowledge and thank Jason and all of our staff. Right now, we have one, as I struggle with my puppy, the joy of working at home these days. But we have one active COVID case right now in the county. And I've had a few people who have looked at the confirmed cases, which I think are right now at 168. There was a bit of misunderstanding that is the number of active cases we currently have, but just sort of acknowledging publicly that you have to subtract the number of confirmed recovered cases from the confirmed cases. That is a running tally of how many cases we have had since the beginning of this crisis is 168. We have 168 confirmed recovered, so I'm just acknowledging publicly that that means we only have one active case. The whole community has done an amazing job at following the social distancing and the health guidelines from the Department of Health. And honestly, I just wanted to thank the community for that. It has been tremendously hard on everyone. So I know there is concern about the schools coming back online. We have an active continuing conversation with the schools about the protocols that they're taking. There was a conversation in Martha chairs the intergovernmental committee, which we call Tiger Committee. And we did have a conversation that was recorded with Cornell, and I encourage people to watch that video. I think it was very helpful to get the protocols. So I guess I'm just acknowledging those things publicly, and we'll continue those conversations. But a shout out to the community for this amazing work, and Jason and the staff as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Anna. Henry.
Yeah, so I also want to talk about that Cornell is having a town hall meeting tomorrow at 7 on Zoom to talk about the coronavirus. They have Frank Cooper, and Marty Stallone from the hospital, and the provost talking. And so, again, tune in for the town hall meeting.
Thank you for the announcement, Henry. I know Cornell has been pushing it so that, because we know the community, has concerns and questions about what it would look like. So thank you. Anyone else? All right, moving on. One thing about where the chair's report fall, by the time you get to it, Anna and Martha tonight have already given what I was going to say. So thank you. I don't have to repeat it. And indeed, shout out to Jason and Dominic and Frank and Amy and Lisa and everyone who's been working at the EOC and beyond for the work you've been doing to keep Tompkins County relatively safe amidst this whole coronavirus matter, pandemic. And thanks again, just to reiterate, Anna, to the community for their part in it. Our group was acknowledged by the chamber for the work they've been doing, and I certainly appreciate that acknowledgement for all that really important work. It almost makes us feel like we're in our own bubble and protected, although we know we're not.
and we still have to be safe, and we want to keep encouraging the community to wear their mask and take all the precautions we've been advising. So thank you all. County Administrator Jason, sorry.
Appointments.
I do have appointments. I don't know what I'll do without Kathy. I'm telling you, she's not allowed to retire anytime soon. Chair's appointments. To the Workforce Development Board, we have two individuals. Terry Tarshis is a business representative. The term expires June 30th of 2021. And Chris Malcolm, who's also business representative, the term expires June 30th of 2022. Those two folks appointed to the Workforce Development Board. And at some point, I know one of you, I can't remember who it was, that asked about getting a better understanding of what the Workforce Development Board does, and maybe at one of our soon meetings we'll have someone come and present so we have a better idea. Okay? It's still in my head. I'm going to make it happen, I promise. County Administrator Jason Molina.
Good evening. Thank you, Leslin, and thank you all for your encouraging words, and thanks to Frank and the Public Health Department for doing an exceptional job over the past 4 months, and the community deserves a pat on the back as well for making it all happen and working collaboratively. So we appreciate the support and the community partners. Everyone has really come together, I think, and has really stood out a lot more than any other community to really make this happen, and it's been a great effort and a good collaboration. So thank you very much. I'm going to share a screen with everyone. It's basically an update, similar formats to the past that we've had. Can everybody see that?
Yes, sir.
Yep, great. So this is an update, similar format as in the past. I'll just remind folks that on our public health webpage, we put them together one after another, so we have a pretty exceptional timeline. From the start of this, we've been doing these updates every legislative meeting, I think, since early April, which has included both the start from COVID response. So if there's a good timeline, good chronological order, as you can kind of go through things. To build off of a little what Anna mentioned earlier, we've had 168 cases, positive cases total. We've only had two since the last legislative meeting, which was 3 weeks ago, which is pretty exceptional, and 167 recovered. So we have one active case. Again, good to see a county our size, population-wise, also having very little new cases, which is not the case for a lot of other communities in our state, and is obviously outside our state as well. A flurry of activity regarding executive orders. I'm not going to go through them all, just a series of executive orders over the past 3 weeks. One specifically that came out last week, quarantine restrictions on travelers arriving in New York. This originally started with, I think, 12 or 13 quarantine restrictions for folks coming from what was labeled essentially hot states with certain metrics of increased positive cases and hospitalizations. That list has expanded. I was even added to today with additional states. I don't have the numbers off the top of my head. I know Frank probably does. But and this has been a major change in the state's approach. If you remember earlier in March, other states were essentially doing this to New Yorkers traveling in other states. And now we are turning around with similar types of quarantine requests that folks that are either traveling through these states for an extended period of time, more than 24 hours at a time, are requested to quarantine for 14 days. Folks coming in from those states, if they're not New Yorkers, are still requesting that they quarantine. So significant change. At the same time, there's been some expansion of phase four, which is including some larger gatherings. And then also late last night, with a few hours to spare, the renewal of the virtual meeting, open meetings, executive order with a few other things like virtual notaries and so on and so forth. So a lot of executive orders at this stage of the game, they're constantly being kind of renewed or expanded upon with respect to executive orders. I should mention that our DMV is allowing now, or has been allowed, in-person, appointment only, in-person business activities. I've spoken to Maureen. Things have gone smoothly. She was a fan of the appointment software that the state had imposed, and they are very busy with activities, so that's good. General County of Operations, we continue to have meetings with a variety of different partners, Board of Realtors, continue with our higher ed folks. We have a subgroup on a communication subgroup with our higher ed team as well. And then we also obviously moved Southern Tier moved into phase four last week. Still no gyms, malls, or movie theaters, and they reaffirmed that today on the control room call that does not appear that gyms, malls, and movie theaters will be opened or allowed to reopen anytime in the near future. So that I take that as the next week or two. That's right now the near future. And we did issue some travel guidance and quarantine guidance to our own employees regarding travel, voluntary travel, and quarantine guidance has to come from that. And we did have the second expanded budget committee meeting to talk about really what the rest of the year looks like as of last week, and then what we're looking at for 2021 and some budget direction. And I'd be happy to talk a little bit more about that after this presentation, if you'd like. Communication-wise, again, very very active. Appreciate the Chamber of Commerce mentioning us and identifying us and recognizing us for Member of the Week. They've obviously been a big partner as well, so we appreciate their collaboration through all of this, and we appreciate the recognition. Community town halls continue to get a good attendance. We'll have another one, I believe, this Thursday, and I suspect there'll be some new topics to discuss. Cornell, IC, and then also this week, TC3, I believe, has announced their reopening. A partial reopening. I have another slide on that to talk a little bit about it. And then our health department has done some good press and press communication around July 4th safety, as well as discouraging unnecessary travel to the best that people can. I believe Frank is going to pick up this slide. We updated some of our demographic information. But Frank, do you want to take this slide?
Yes, thanks, Jason. And the states that were added were Kansas, Oklahoma, and Delaware for a total of 19 states now covered under the quarantine travel order.
Thank you.
So we wanted to share some information because we're getting a lot of questions about travel, obviously, with the way things are evolving around the country. And what you see on this slide is essentially an outline of the relationship between travel and our positive cases. You'll remember that we only have 168 total, and so the numbers are still very, very small, and it makes it difficult to draw any conclusions, but we wanted to at least be able to share this. So you'll see over the course of March, April, May, and June how travel influenced the positive cases that we've seen amongst our positives here in Tompkins. It is important, and Jason pointed out, we haven't had a lot of cases, and there's been a lot of requests for additional demographic information like we did back in, I think it was late May, when we had 133 cases. We're only 35 above that since then. So it is difficult, once again, to share too much information while protecting the privacy of the individuals. We do plan for our next LEDGE meeting to update that demographic data, hoping that there won't be too many additional cases to add, and we'll be talking about, about 170 cases total. While I understand the want for more information, and we will work to provide that, our numbers are still too low to draw any conclusions from, regardless of what you see. You can see with our travel that there's six cases in June. You can't draw anything really from that. So we recognize it, and we are working on it. We are also working, Henry, I apologize, we don't have them yet, but we're working on demographic information collaboration with Cuyahoga Medical Center for the tested numbers. There's a lot of question about how many unique individuals that is, and what the demographics of those folks are. So we're working with CMC, and we'll get that data out as soon as we can.
Thanks, Frank. I take this one as well.
Yeah, so this is just kind of a summary of what our Environmental Health Division has been doing. You can see across the different phases and where we are, the approximate number of calls that they've been fielding and what they've been able to do. You can see the extent of the number of facilities that we regulate, that we've been providing guidance to, public water supplies. We're doing field inspections for on-site wastewater treatment. So along with all the COVID stuff, we are getting back to some of the regular work that we have to do as businesses do continue to reopen. So it is important to know that our Environmental Health Division has been a key component of our reopening and providing information and guidance to our community partners, while at the same time trying to do as much of their regular work as they can.
Thanks, Frank. I have here a slide just kind of summarizing the three higher ed institutions. Again, they've all announced similar types of hybrid model or online in-person reopen or reactivation. They both have some different names for it. Staggered return to in-person classroom, staggered in-person returns. The document that I know is available with Cornell is, you know, a short 300-page read. I know Ithaca College is working on a complex document, as well as the Tompkins Cortland Community College. So they're all working on similar approaches. There's a lot of similarities, and there are some nuances and differences based on the type of institution they are. We've been meeting with them regularly, Frank, more so in the public health department, I think, just on a regular basis, talking about a lot of different approaches they're taking. I know they've been in constant contact with CMC about how they incorporate testing into their conversations, and I know we've been part of that. So while the ink is still wet on a lot of these plans, I would also say that they can still change. The past 2 weeks have been an interesting 2 weeks. Everybody around us is going through what we went through quite a few months ago. There has been different responses to different states and different municipalities across the states, across the country. It's unknown on how those results may impact us. They will impact us and the state of New York in one way or another. We don't know how that is yet. And we don't know if it's going to have some secondary impact on the higher ed institutions as they go through their development plan. So while they've issued some documents and some perspectives and some positions, I think it's still safe to say a lot of it is still under development, and it's subject to change, which I think is concerning at times, particularly with the uncertainty of what's going on in the future. I will say, and I've said this before, and I want to continue to commend higher ed for communicating probably the most they ever have with each other as well as with us. A pandemic, I guess, to get this level of collaboration and cooperation, but it's been good to be able to work with them, and they continue to work hard. They are spending a lot of time developing approaches that are going to ensure the safety of their students, their faculty, their staff, and the community. In our conversations, we have encouraged, and I think they have also accepted and are willing to continue to have as many public conversations they can and provide some transparency to their approaches. And I think there's a meeting, I think Henry mentioned this Wednesday. I know Frank's going to be there. I'll be present, but I'm not part of the discussion. And I know they're going to have more public forums and community forums to take questions, answer questions, get feedback so that the community has an understanding of their approaches that they're taking and the transparency of their process. And frankly, that it could change, and they're going to need that opportunity to explain those changes. So this is just really to talk about our three higher ed institutions and where they're at in their planning process and some of the things that have come out. Again, a lot to still be determined and to be finalized. This is a familiar slide now. Talks about COVID hours. Again, regular hours are regular hours worked, OT hours. Some is paid in overtime pay, and some is paid in comp time, or I'm sorry, is earned in comp time. A big portion of this, though, is not realized, as most of these are management confidential employees that are not did not get compensated much beyond their 40-hour work week. But this kind of gives you an understanding of the amount of time and energy spent in COVID-related hours. Here's an estimate of emergency leave. As you can see, it really, descended after April 4th timeframe. And this should be the last pay period because at the beginning of this, June 27th, I think we only had emergency leave for another day or two. And then we ended it as we started to slowly bring back staff, both remotely as well as in our buildings. So that will, there shouldn't be any more emergency leave after this one, after this date. And then COVID-related expenses, and this has a variety of expenses. There are also expenses related to the primary and the election process that were specifically attributed to COVID-19 in terms of that. You talked about thousands of absentee ballots for probably the most that's ever happened before. And that may continue into the general election, depending on how things pan out over the next several months. So that's yet to be determined. But this is really the gist of the slides I have. I can talk a little bit and would be happy to discuss, kind of build off of our conversation a little bit from last Tuesday budget-wise. But before we go to that, are there any specific questions about any of these slides with respect to COVID response?
So I can't see you.
Can't see me? How about this?
I can't see anyone there. Any questions for Jason on the presentation? Shauna?
Thank you for continuing to update us. I was wondering, Frank and or Jason, if you can tell us what the requirements are in order to receive a COVID test.
Sure. So right now the criteria have not changed for the drive-through at the mall that CMC operates. The last addition was protesters was added. The governor has expanded testing to all New Yorkers, but the only place that is guaranteed to be free is at New York State run sampling sites, which the closest to us would be Onondaga or Broome. Payment, reimbursement for non-medically necessary testing and government mandated testing is a question that we've been trying to get an answer, and it's starting to become more clear that everyone getting tested that wants it for free had a lot of caveats to it, and so CMC is working through what that will look like, and we are partnering with them to advocate with the state for more clarity and to make sure that there's as much testing as can be available here in Tompkins County.
So just to clarify, if you have one of the noted symptoms, then you are able to get a test.
Yes. So,
but if you are traveling from a different location, as in one of the 16 or 20 states, then you are not eligible for a test. Is that correct?
Currently at our at the drive-through in Tompkins County, yes. Any New Yorker can go to any of the state-run ones, and they could get tested, irregardless of criteria.
Thank you.
Annie?
Thank you. So my question comes mostly about the next couple of months for our response and managing to keep the infection rate as low as possible for COVID. So I've heard a lot of info on students coming back to college, to the colleges, and so a lot of people are very concerned. Some people are not concerned, but there's a lot of people that are saying they're very concerned about that. And then I'm hearing the governor say, well, it's up to local municipalities, local governments to do enforcement of things like social distancing and mask wearing. And so I'm wondering about these two things coming together. I know we've talked before about, well, we don't want to necessarily arrest somebody or do something like that, but I'm wondering if we wanted to do something, and I'm not pushing for this, but I'm just putting the question out there, do we want to do something like impose fines or something like that? Because otherwise, I just want to pose that question, because I think it's going to be harder if we do want to do something, it's going to be harder to do it later after 20, 30,000 students come in versus if we do something now.
That's a conversation that is ongoing right now, and with higher ed about the enforcement, the communication in both with, you know, with folks coming back, you know, students coming back, as well as with the community, how to address the issue, as well as with, you know, how do we approach the enforcement perspective. So I know, and again, I'll just preface it with that this is an ongoing conversation as to what's the best approach. I don't know that we have a clear-cut conclusion yet, but it is on the forefront of our discussion with them. I know all of the higher ed institutions are working collaboratively to have similar messaging and communication and approaches with their students about code of conducts, how they're going to, you know, encourage code of conduct with their students, how they want to, you know, they're engaging with their student leadership also to get input and feedback from them as to how they feel they can approach it best. You know, students are very smart, they're wise, they understand the student body very well and are working to try to develop what's the best approach from a communication perspective, and then from a follow-up, and then if need be from an enforcement perspective. So I don't think we have a clear-cut answer, and Frank, you jump in at any point in time, but I know it is an ongoing conversation and one of the more, you know, important elements of folks coming back and how do we approach it. To step away from that, you know, we continue and have all along been the enforcement arm with respect to business compliance, employee compliance, patron compliance. And we have had, for the most part, a lot of success just with simple dialogue, education, and working with businesses. We are starting to have some less success, and we are now starting to have more aggressive dialogue, and if need be, may have to have some notice of violations issued to certain businesses if there isn't cooperation or collaboration. We're not at that point yet. We're in that dialogue right now this week and trying to understand, you know, what some of the challenges are. But to your point exactly, you know, starting out with the appropriate steps from the onset will be important so that complacency doesn't settle in and expectations don't change once folks arrive back on campus, just as we have with our enforcement approach from the get-go, you know, aside from higher ed. So it's a good question. It's a question that we are working actively with them to partner with them so that we have good solutions and multiple. I think it's a multi-pronged approach. It's just not an enforcement approach. There's a sense of responsibility on everyone's part, just as this whole process is involved. There's a lot of personal responsibility in this. It's an education piece. There's responsibility on higher ed as an institution, on the students, on us, and how to approach it from a successful avenue is what we're trying to work together with on.
Thank you.
Henry?
Yes, I know there was a conference call today in the White House about K-12. And I really haven't heard anything about the K-12 system and if what's going to happen. I know it's the governor's decision, but I've not heard anything. So can you guys enlighten us?
Yeah, so the governor said this week that he's essentially directed all of the school districts to begin developing plans for what school might look like in the fall. But he was very clear to say no decision has been made yet about K-12 in the fall. I meet weekly with the senior leadership of Ithaca City School District to answer questions for them as they're navigating both their summer implementation education as well as planning for the fall. And we've had several conversations with Dr. Madison at TSD BOCES, you know, offering our support to all the districts in the county as they start to do this. I can tell you it is a bit challenging to develop a plan with no framework for what it might look like from the decision makers. And so I think they're going to be forced to kind of write plan A, B, C, and D, you know, based off of the different scenarios that might unfold over the next few weeks. But no decision has been made, but I know the districts are working diligently in trying to be as prepared as possible.
Thank you, Frank. Anna? Oh, sorry. Henry, go ahead.
In the terms of the quarantine policy, how's it being enforced on the people coming from out of state?
So really, it's when we become aware of it, then we contact the individuals and we go through the notification process. The state has set up you probably heard about the contact tracing army that the governor was standing up with the Bloomberg Foundation. Ultimately, they developed a software that we're now using for our contact investigations, and this is actually the first time that we've allowed or called upon on that kind of expanded capacity. So what happens is we put the name and contact information into the system. The individuals are contacted. There's a virtual process that sends them notification that they need to quarantine and then sets up regular communication with them, mostly through text if possible, but then using phone if necessary. But that It really is at this point when we become aware of individuals. We're not actively seeking out people that have traveled from other parts of the country.
Anna?
Two questions. One related to outdoor events. I thought I saw that the Commons Thursday night concert series is happening again, but maybe that's virtual. Maybe I missed it.
Virtual.
It is virtual.
It is virtual.
And so, okay, I thought it was, but a question about events specifically about outdoor events. Until the number that the state is allowing is greater than or is relaxed, the 50 or less, that affects all public events, regardless of whether they're indoors or outdoors, correct?
Yes. Yeah, we're trying to limit gatherings to 50 or less.
And the other question was related to students living off campus. One of the questions that a constituent had was testing for students that live in the city or town off campus. Those tests are still done on campus, correct? They're not going to be done by the county or CMC.
Correct. Cornell is committed to doing the same thing for all students, regardless of whether they live on campus or off.
And then the last half of that question was, I had heard, or more a comment for confirmation, that Cornell is going to be working on enforcement. They have to have a test before they come to school, then after they get here before they're allowed to engage, and they'll be tested regularly. And there was some comment in a presentation that they're working on an enforcement policy, including up to kicking students out potentially if they are not following policy. Is that what you've heard? Is that the guidelines that it's sort of directing towards?
So they have developed a behavioral contract. I'm not sure if that's the exact terminology that they'll be asking students to sign, and I do believe they're still working on what it would mean for from an enforcement perspective.
Perfect. That was what I wanted to know, how we hold them to it, so they would have to sign it. That's very helpful, Frank. Thank you.
All right, Martha?
Thanks, Leslie. Thanks, Frank and Jason, for this. I have two questions. In listening to news about other states, it seems that I've seen some mayors or counties setting lower limits for gatherings than their states have set. Is that something we've thought about or would consider? And I'm especially thinking about sort of off-campus parties that people are especially worried about. Is there any way in which we could do that, and is it something we've thought about?
Well,
lower than 50.
Early on in this process, in one of the governor's executive orders, he limited local municipalities' abilities to issue executive orders or restrictions without getting New York State Department of Health approval before doing so. And from most of the folks that we've heard that have attempted to do that, they have been denied. It requires state approval for us to do something more significant than they're doing, and there hasn't been a track record of those being approved.
Okay. I won't make a snarky comment about it. Okay.
I think to your point is if we feel we get to an a circumstance where we have good reason to want to do that, we can we'll definitely have that conversation and run it up the flagpole and say, listen, these are the reasons why. It could be that could be the example you gave could be a good enough reason to do it. So I think when we get to that point, we can have that conversation.
Okay, thank you. And Frank, I don't know if you were on when we were talking to George McGonigal from the city about sort of the heat wave and people trying to cool down, and that we used to have air conditioned spaces, the library and the mall and other places where we could help people go whose homes aren't cool enough. Is there anything like that that we can offer? Have you thought about that? It's really hot. It's been for a while, and it's going to still be for a number more days.
Yeah, we have had some conversation about it with the Department of Emergency Response. Amy Hendricks was leading that conversation. There aren't real good solutions, right, because everything that we would have used in the past for COVID-19 reasons would not be a good source now. And particularly the people that we're worried about from the heat are vulnerable populations with COVID-19, so we don't want to bring them to places where they could be potentially exposed. So really what we would encourage our community is to check on your neighbors, particularly if you know that they're elderly or they have other concerns that the heat might be of significant issue to them, and try to work on one-on-one solutions. We're continuing to talk about it, and if and when we come up with more concrete options, we'll certainly share those.
I wonder if talking to 211 and kind of problem solving and seeing if they get calls like that, maybe we can at least provide some individual, person-to-person help.
Yeah, 211 is always a good source. We have a great relationship with them. So if they are getting calls that they don't have answers for, they will certainly let us know that, and we'll do what we can to support people.
Great. Thanks, Frank.
Well, the bottom line is we definitely want people to be checking on each other. We've been saying that throughout this pandemic. It's extremely important that we add heat on top of it. Please, encourage to check on folks, because we, like Frank said, we don't want people to then be sauntering out of their homes, getting, exposure to one thing in order to deal with something else. And, it's a real catch-22. Henry, you have the last word on this, and then I'm moving on.
Okay. Any word on a downtown testing site?
Henry, you no longer have the last word. Good question.
What? I said, any word on a downtown testing site?
No, not at this moment. I think that's part of the challenge that CMC is dealing with right now with respect to testing criteria and reimbursement for testing. So right now I don't have any new. I have not had that recent conversation with the hospital. I don't think it's come up recently. Has it, Frank?
No.
Yeah.
Also, one last question. I know Cornell did the study about pool testing. I know they're going to plan on doing that. Will that be for the whole county, or will that just be for Cornell testing?
Yeah, no, pool testing is the method that CMC is working towards doing for the whole population. So as they validate that, they're working on it, and they're in the process of validating the ability to do pool testing without having to collect the second samples, which would be the ideal solution to increase capacity pretty significantly.
Hey, thank you.
All right. Anything else, Jason or Frank? Okay, thank you.
Out of the COVID matter, Leslin, I could just briefly touch on the budget discussion from Tuesday, if that's all right.
I'm having a hard time hearing. What did you say?
I want to know into the budget discussion now.
Oh, yeah, sure. As part of your report, go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to pick up where we left off a little bit on Tuesday, not looking for a whole in-depth conversation, but I think it's important that, you know, we have a series of decisions to consider over the course of the next 2 weeks. Earlier in May, when made the decision to furlough staff, it was a temporary decision with the understanding that there could be more extensions or permanent furloughs, as well as further expense reductions. I'm going to be meeting with department heads this week to have that conversation a little bit further about furloughs or extending the furloughs. We had a brief overview of the financial outlook for this year, which is still not positive. You're still anywhere between $5 to $11 million of a deficit. So further expense reductions is something we're going to take a look at later this week. And bring to budget capital and personnel to have some further dialogue and input from, but would like to have at least some feedback or initial input from the legislator or legislators if later this week anyone who wants to have a conversation about it as we start to learn some more information about financial outlook. Rick is going to get some the final fourth quarter, the final payment for June sales tax, I believe later this week, early next week. So we'll have a better picture of how June fares, but everything right now is pointing in the direction of, obviously nothing better than what we projected. I don't know what that last payment's going to be, so I can't predict, but we're continuing to have a financial, we're going to run an operating deficit this year into the multi-millions. So continuing to make some fourth quarter adjustments is probably something to consider. Just wanted to pick up where we left off on Tuesday and have any input or feedback from legislators about those issues.
All right, so we'll get, stuff from you and definitely give our feedback. I know there are two staff people waiting, and so I'll go to Deborah and then the others.
Thank you. Thank you, Leslin, and thank you, Jason. Welcome back from your vacation. You mentioned that we're going to be running a multi-million-dollar deficit this year, and I know that we're not going to be able to plug that hole by simply reducing expenses.
Correct.
We're going to have to go into our funds. I was wondering what the procedure was going to be. Usually at the end of the year, there's this flood of balancing and money moved from one place to another. But obviously, are we going to be setting some sort of limit on how much of our fund balance we should be using to make up the gap before you go ahead and spend it?
That's a very difficult question to answer, only because it's almost impossible right now to understand what this isn't a single incident event that has triggered a shortcoming in revenue or anything along those lines. It's a constant event that's lasting through the end of the year. Generally, in this circumstance, and Rick and I have had some conversation about this. We're probably going to have a lot more about it in the upcoming weeks. It's very difficult to say, all right, we're going to use X amount of fund balance to balance the budget. Essentially, what you're doing is you're not appropriating the fund balance to balance the budget. You're essentially acknowledging and recognizing the shortfall in revenue and running an operating deficit that will ultimately be pulling fund balance down to essentially balance the budget at the end of the year or paying expenses. Amending the budget to appropriate fund balance is an approach to take. I've never done that before to this extent, and I don't know that other municipalities are approaching it that way as well. Most of them are taking the approach, at least counties are, we have to minimize the negative operating, we have to minimize the operating deficit to the best extent that we can, where in other circumstances you may appropriate fund balance for a one-time expenditure that you didn't expect or a one-time shortfall in revenue you didn't expect. This is a lot. This is a different animal because it's of a much larger magnitude.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know that we can take that approach with it. So, unfortunately, I can't answer your question head on. Other than I think the only thing I could say is, do you want to minimize the operating deficit to the best extent you can, but also probably accept the fact that you're not going to be able to have revenues meet expenditures this year by simple expenditure cuts.
No, I understand that. I guess what I'm asking for is some sort of iterative process as we go through this so that we don't end up at the end of the year finding out that we used X amount of, you know, fund balance, surprise, which may be more than we would have chosen to spend, and we might have looked for other ways to reduce expenses. Because my fear is that we're going to be going through another 2 or 3 years after this of trying to recover from this mess. And if we're too generous reaching into our fund balance, we're not going to make it through.
I think the one way you monitor this is monthly we have these conversations about where we are financially, which is what you've done. You didn't want to do it again in July and again in August. And I think that's the only way you can monitor it so far. As we get closer to the year, we're going to see whether or not that that gap, that deficit is going to be growing or whether it's going to be shrinking. Right now, it's kind of staying a little bit where we are, maybe shrinking a little bit. I hate to throw this out there because it's unnerving and it creates a lot of anxiety. But the truth is I have no idea how next month is going to react or the month after based on everything that's going on around us.
Nobody does.
Yeah, so I think the best thing we can do is do this on a monthly basis, Deborah, and Budget Capital and Personnel Committee meeting maybe the avenue to do it, but also we're also updating the legislature on a monthly basis as well and continue to do that and try to continue to narrow that gap as best we can with probably some reasonable understanding that we're going to probably still run a deficit and use some fund balance. If we see things go off the charts in a bad direction one way or the other, then we can react to it. I don't think it'll move that quickly, though. So I think the best thing to do is to monitor it monthly, have the conversation regularly. We continue to update our numbers regularly and then make decisions based off of that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. Anyone else? Oh, Martha.
Thank you. Jason, as we're talking, I just thought, you know, maybe there's some kind of a dashboard that, you know, what are the key metrics, and we can kind of come in on a monthly, you know, set the parameters of, like, upper and lower targets and kind of watch where we're going on a month-to-month basis. Some key figures might be a helpful guide for us.
Yeah, I mean, the range is kind of what we started talking about. The range is, you know, a good place to start with that, and we can build upon that to kind of show you. And we react to that based on the prior month's experience to the best we can. It's not perfect. It's not fine-tuned, but it gives you general ballparks of where we can go. And we'll continue to use that range if that works. I think that's a good way of looking at it just because of some of the uncertainties with sales tax and state aid. Those are the big-ticket items.
Well, certainly, thanks, Martha, and thanks, Jason. Certainly we'll continue to, as Jason said, I mean, we had a brief conversation, bringing ideas and suggesting, letting us know where things are going so that legislators have an opportunity to, you know, help with the brainstorming or weighing in and some of the policy decisions that we might have to make. So we'll all be at this continuously, just so we all know. So we're prepared, and I encourage people also, if you're able to attend the Budget and Capital Committee meeting and Personnel Committee meetings, because a lot of the discussion happens there as well. So if you're able to do attend, but it doesn't mean that the rest of us won't have an opportunity to weigh in, because we'll keep these conversations going alive as we can. It's different these days on what's going on. All right, I'm going to go quickly to Jonathan and then Rick, and then let's get Dwight and Mike home. Jonathan, anything from you?
Hello?
Hi, Jonathan.
Hi. I'll be very quickly because I have no report. Obviously, if people have any questions, I'd be happy to answer that.
Any questions for Jonathan? Mike Lane.
Hi, Jonathan. You sent around a confidential memorandum, and I wondered two things. Who solicited it? And second, why it was confidential?
I'll answer the second one first. Pretty much any memorandum I give to the legislature on law is, from my perspective, confidential. If you or your colleagues want to do something with it or make it public, that's fine with me. But from my point, I'm your attorney, and so it's confidential from me to you. Obviously, if the legislature wants to make that memo public, that's fine with me. It's confidential between us, not between me and the public. What was the other question, Mike?
I asked who solicited it.
Actually, the vice chair asked for it, and she had said that she had spoken with some other members who were interested in having it.
Thank you. Jonathan, after not the last GO meeting, but the one before that, in which I brought up the issue of whether if we failed to redistrict or change our terms, we might be open to a lawsuit, you said at that meeting that that wouldn't happen. The next morning you called me up, and I wondered if you could take it from there.
Yeah, no, I didn't say it didn't happen, wouldn't happen. Obviously, anybody can sue, and I have no control. What I was offering is my opinion that either course of action that the legislature was considering would, in my opinion, be more likely than not to survive a court challenge, and that's what the memo explained, going through the law. Obviously, there's no 100% guarantee on anything. It was just sort of my analysis of the law, as well as the facts, and that I thought that a challenge to either course that the legislature was considering would be unsuccessful, and the legislature could make its decision based on what it thought it was the right thing to do. And I thought, you know, while it could be a legal challenge either way, I thought either path the legislature would take would be more likely than not to be upheld.
But, of course, you said to me, didn't you, that, that you had said at the GO meeting that there weren't cases, but that you looked at it again and there were cases that you mentioned, and you backed as your memo recites one in Tompkins County. Mm-hmm. So I just want people to understand when I have made the comment that you called me up after that meeting and say that, yes, you weren't exactly right when you said there were no cases, that I wasn't making things up.
With all due respect, I mean, I certainly know of that case, and certainly you were right to bring it up, and you were correct that there was that case. I wasn't saying there wasn't. What I was saying was that, I believe my exact words were that I hadn't known any case, what I said at the meeting, where a court had actually required a county to, had actually overturned what we are calling the no action alternative, or had forced them to go to weighted voting. That wasn't the case in that case, the county 40 years ago, the county had done that itself voluntarily. No court didn't order that. The county did that. So what I had said, and to be exact, is I know no case. Of course, that was 40 years ago in which a court has ordered that. And that is what I said. I mean, maybe it was sort of misunderstood, but that's what I said. And that is correct. I wasn't saying that there wasn't that case 40 years ago where the county had gone to weighted voting, but the county decided to do that. It wasn't ordered to do that.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. Deborah?
Thank you, Leslin. Let me say, this has been such a hotly debated issue among the legislatures that I actually suggested to Shauna that she request an opinion from our county attorney, because I think that he's our county attorney and we should be entitled as legislators to rely on his legal advice. Now, I happen to be one of the people who voted for the two-year term, but I do think, in view of, you know, Mr. Lynch's public comment today, that it needs to be put out there that the substance of Jonathan's advice, as I understand it, and Jonathan can correct me if I'm wrong, please do, is that there's no – we're not in violation of any constitutional provision if we fail to redistrict in shorter order, or if we go forward as we are currently constituted without implementing weighted voting, unless and until the difference in the census data is more than 10%. Is that correct, Jonathan?
Honestly, I think, and maybe it's good to, you know, to release the memo, but I think both things. I think even if, under some of the courts, even if the data was more than 10%, that, you know, based on those more recent cases, which I cited, that the county legislature would not be obligated to redistrict prior to the election. That is regardless of the numbers, whether they exceeded the general 10% threshold or not. I also pointed out that based on the preliminary data, it looks like they probably don't.
Thank you.
Okay. Martha.
Thank you, Leslin. Thanks, Jonathan. That 10%, is that the difference from one district to another? I mean, if one district is overrepresented by 5% and another district is underrepresented by 5%, is that the 10% you're talking about?
Right. So let me explain. Let's say there are 14 districts as there are. If the difference between the district with the largest population and the district with the smallest population is 10% or less. For example, the one with the most population has 500 and the one with the least population has 480, then it would be less than 10%. So if the difference between the highest and the lowest is 10% or more, or less, excuse me, it is presumed constitutional. By presumed, that doesn't mean it's necessarily constitutional, but it almost always is. The only way you really overcome that presumption is, for example, if the districts were drawn based on race or something like that. But if it's just a population thing and that they're within, the highest and the lowest are within 10%, it's presumed constitutional under the case law.
Okay, so as I think you said in the email you wrote, or the memo, the preliminary census data you are referring to was that article from the, I guess, the Ithaca Times, and then I went, you know, and looked at the underlying spreadsheets. Those are population figures for municipalities, which is the same as our election districts.
That's
so, given that I don't, off the top of my head, know what the variation in our districts is right now, I don't know whether we're close enough and whether we end up with more than 10% or less, because I don't know how close we are right now.
Yeah, it's fair to say at this point that it's really impossible to tell for sure. What you can tell basically is, you know, for example, in other places in the country, you might see huge discrepancies and very large between towns and villages within. It may be, you know, when the preliminary census data could show 30% difference between the highest and the lowest. In our case right now, it shows 8.5. So the chances are that when we redistrict, the difference...
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the number. Right now,
8.5 between the highest municipality and the lowest, based on the preliminary data.
If you go back, I still didn't hear.
It was like,
you said 3.5 or 8.5.
Right, so the largest was up like 5%, and the smallest was down like 3% or something like that. So it's about 8%. If you go back 10 years, I think it was 14 or 15%. Mm-hmm. But it's just a general indication of how much the population's changed. In other words, it's a general indication that there's not been a huge increase or huge change in the population, which will translate somewhat into redistricting. It's obviously not a perfect correlation.
Okay. Another question. If we went to a two-year term, and then so our legislature election would be 2023, would be in at the same time as existing local elections? So is it right there would not be an extra cost? It's the same part of the same election process?
Well, they really have to ask the Board of Elections. Obviously, when you have to have a special election or a separate election, the cost becomes significant. If something is at the time is another election, the cost is less significant, but I can't say it's not.
Okay. And finally, could you describe how weighted voting would be carried out? Is that something where we'd have to have a referendum? Does the charter have to change? What has to happen if...
Yeah, it would be subject to mandatory referendum. Basically, you'd have to have a local law changing it. I mean, it would be premature now because you basically don't know the numbers yet, right? So, although I suppose one could do it based on some formula. But it would be a local law, just like the change to 2 years would be, and it would be subject to mandatory referendum.
Okay, and just, okay.
Go on. Never mind.
Just one other question. If somebody did want to move to reconsider, what part of the meeting would that happen tonight? And you said, I think you said earlier that it would happen tonight.
Yeah, the best part would be unfinished business. Yeah. I talked with Kathy about it. And actually, one thing in redrafting our rules, Amanda, we may want to directly address that question. But the best part, to put it, is an unfinished business.
Thanks very much. Appreciate the time.
Sure.
Anything else for Jonathan? All right. Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you for the memo. Thank you for explaining. We've got to move on. Are the finance director, Greg, you have anything for us?
Yes, I have three short items. I sent them off to you in an email about 10 or 15 minutes before the meeting started. So if you have access to the email, you'll have access to the hard copy report. Three short things that we're going to look at tonight is your contingency fund, the most recent band sale, a short look at room tax revenues year to date. On the first part of the report, as you know, your contingency fund is set up to take care of items that aren't thought of during the budgeting process, and departments have needs that come up throughout the year. And so this $900,000 appropriation sits in what we call the contingency fund. You also make some allocations during the budgeting process for specific items that you want to bring back and look at later during the fiscal year, because you haven't put them into the department's budgets, but you want it to have some money sitting somewhere, and that the legislature over the years has added some dollars to the contingency fund during your normal, during your budget workshop during the summer. So we start off this year, 2020, with a $900,000 contingency balance. We've only had 11 appropriations come from that so far. that total $366,000. And on the report, I've listed each of the 11 items that constitute that $366,000, which leaves a balance of $533,000 out of that $900,000, which is pretty good for this time of year because that represents about 41% expenditure of the fund, and we're halfway through the year. So we're a little bit under where that 50% would be for 6 months during the year. The second page of my report shows a subaccount that we have in the contingency called Project Contingency. And during the budget process, we have another $81,116 for specific project grants. And out of that appropriation, none of that has been spent year to date. So that money still sits there intact, $81,116. So that's bringing you up to date where we are on what's left in your contingency fund. Do you have any questions on that before I move on? Okay.
No, go ahead.
Go ahead. All righty. The second part of my report has to do with our June 30th sale of bands. As you know, we were looking to sell $3 million worth of bands, which are bond anticipation notes. They're only for 7 months, and this is for the airport. The $3 million is on top of the $10 million that we went out to the bond market for just a few months ago, back in February. So this additional Series C band is for $3 million. It sold on June 30th, which was the official market date, at 0.85%. That's the net interest rate. So we did fairly good with that offering. There were just four bidders. One of them was J.P. Morgan Chase Bank, which is one of the banks that the county does business with. And they were also the purchaser of the $10 million notes back in February. So that's J.P. Morgan Chase Bank. Again, it's just a maturity of 7 months, comes due in February when the other band comes due. I've listed on the handout or the email that I sent to you all the rates that bands had we've achieved over the last 10 years or so. And you can see they go everywhere from 0.18% all the way up to about 2%. So we did really well. We're kind of in the middle. Interest rates are very good. And this answers a lot of questions legislators have asked me over the last couple months. During this crisis, during this market upset, just 60 days ago, a lot of people were worrying if we could even float municipal debt on the market. So we were successful in this effort this time. Are there any questions on this one? Okay.
Oh.
Go ahead.
No questions. Go ahead.
Oh, no question. The last one, and I'll try to make it short, room tax report. We gave some reports out at both the Budget Committee and the GO Committee in the last couple of months, and I'm providing a report to you tonight that shows the room tax right now year-to-date. There's a couple of tables that are in the written report that shows both the gross sales, what the hotels have achieved in the first two quarters of this year, and it also shows the actual amount of room tax that they collected. And to start off with, I thought I'd give you the basic number, which kind of jumps out at you. If you just look at year-to-date from up to July 6th last year, we collected $1,138,000 for the first 6 months and 1 week, $1,138,000. This year, up until yesterday, we collected $390,000. So 390 compared to 1.1 million. That's roughly about a third, 34% of where we were at compared to last year. Questions have been raised. I've emailed individual legislators' responses. We also talked about this at, like I said, at the committee level, but I thought I'd bring everybody up to date on the first quarter returns compared to the second quarter returns. Remember when we reported out to you how many had sent back any returns, no money others had, and we reported back how well we did after we sent out a nasty gram letter to the hotels a couple months ago to get those who didn't pay for the first quarter. Well, here's the results for the first quarter. Now, there are 29 hotels to start with. Out of that 29, one paid half of their amount that was due. All others paid in full, with the exception of three. So we have three that did not pay. One paid a half, and all the others paid in full. Now, of those three, two are owned by the same owner. And they neither sent in their first quarter return, nor did they send in a payment. And the third out of those three is a new hotel in town. And they have not sent in their return or payment, and they have not responded to any of our emails or phone calls. Now we just finished the second quarter, and returns have come in, and payments are due. As of today, of the 29 hotels, four have not sent in any return and no payment. So that's four. Three sent us returns, but with no payments. And all the rest paid in full. But paid in full, in most cases, was zero. So there's a lot of hotels reported, but they had no revenue to report. So the table that I attached showed the gross sales for both 2019 and 2020 compared side by side. And it showed the tax collected for 2019 and 2020 side by side. And like I referenced in the beginning of the report, it was quite a big difference to see that $1.1 million compared to only $390,000 at this point in time is pretty sizable. I'd like to end by saying that this is one of the areas that we've already addressed in our budget with significant budget reductions. If you remember, part of your legislature approval of budget adjustments included a pretty severe cutback in the tourism fund, where we have already reduced the budget, both on the revenue side, bringing it down in room tax. And this was a result of Nick over in the sustainability department bringing this information to you. We brought both the revenue down for room tax, and we brought a whole lot of those grant expenditures down. So this is an example where one particular fund or one particular source of revenue has already been addressed in your budget as far as being reduced, and the associated expenditures that can be reduced have also been reduced. So this is a piecemeal approach, but we can do this all throughout the year when we know that we're going to have significant losses in a revenue and it ties directly to a particular expenditure. We can begin to bring to you more and more budget adjustments that begin to reduce our budget downward. We can possibly work on that when it comes to sales tax, because we're beginning to get a little bit more information on how sales tax is doing. Like Jason said, in about a week or 10 days, we should have numbers for you for the end of the second quarter or the end of June. So it's not like we're not doing anything to make changes to the budget. I think you'll see a significant number of budget adjustments come at you between now and the end of the year that significantly decreases the budget when we compare it with a particular expenditure. And if it has to be met with fund balance, that will be in the budget adjustment also.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much, Rick. Folks, we're going to get through this quickly. Henry, questions?
Yes, Rick, are you going to send nasty grams to the seven hotels that did not pay?
No nasty grams, only wonderful professional asking letters.
They're so well written that we had the county attorney's department write these letters, so you just know how well they're written. And we do have some success with them. So I think we're going to carry forward using the same technique as was used last quarter. Good question.
Also, I know that Nick had made an adjustment to the room tax budget in terms of, you know, basically moving it down from $3 million down to $1.5 million. But also, I assume he worked with you in terms of estimating how much tax would come in. And I'm wondering, where does $390,000 fall in terms of everything overall, in terms of his estimate of $1.5 million?
So your question is on what Nick presented and what was already adjusted. Is your question, should we look at that again to readjust it? Is that what you're asking, Henry?
Well, I'm asking how are things looking in terms of the total amount? Because do you have any estimates for what the third and fourth quarter will be? Do you have a sense that we'll reach the $1.5 million or whether we'll come short of that?
I can answer that question. When planning did their estimates, they did some different scenarios, and they've honed in a little bit on a one reduction that triggered a series of actions that amended the budget, like Rick said. I would say this is, again, one of those things that is being looked at on an ongoing basis. So this is the first time we've really looked at second quarter results, and it's very possible that there could be further reductions, just as you were considering for the general fund, that may come from this. One nuance to this is that generally – past precedent has set that, you know, what money is received through this avenue is what is distributed, and that is all that's distributed, not necessarily distributing more than what you receive. It's never been a severe shortfall as this, but I would say, yes, we're probably going to go through another exercise of reductions or proposed reductions that may be above and beyond what you've already done in the upcoming months, probably once you get closer to the next end of the next quarter. So it's a very good possibility there could be future budget amendments with the hotel tax and the tourism program moving forward. I mean, it's pretty astonishing, the shortfall just from the first two quarters. This industry, from everything I've read, was projected to be one of the hardest hit and probably one of the last to recover. So while it's intense, it's not all surprising that it's been pretty significant.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Jason. Folks, questions? Anna.
Yes, thank you, Rick, for your report. I'm curious if we've gotten any requests from hotels. Two-part question. Any requests from hotels for a payment plan rather than a full payment? And secondly, whether or not we've gotten any communication from hotels that they are at risk of closing, because, of course, that would be a permanent reduction in our room tax that we would need to adjust for, not just this year, but going forward in future years.
I don't know personally of any payment plans that have been suggested. I know that one suggested their own when they sent half of the payment and said, we'll send you the other half when we can. So, in effect, they're on a payment plan. We do charge interest, but and as far as the risk of closing, there are probably some out there that probably are might very well be high risk of closing.
Right. But we haven't gotten any.
Yeah, we haven't gotten any communications from people saying that. Most have said that couldn't or haven't paid. We'll pay you when we get through this crisis. After COVID-19 is over, we'll be sure to pay you. But that's kind of like saying the check's in the mail. We hear that all the time in the Treasury Division. So
yeah, it's a struggle for everyone. Shauna.
Hi, Rick. My question was, I noticed that one of the hotels was actually on the list of that you provided us with places and residences and businesses that had a backlog of property tax. And I was wondering if one of the hotels, one of the three or one of the seven, happened to be this one, because maybe there is a financial situation there that came way, way well before COVID.
There was one of the hotels, what was on our foreclosure list was for a piece of equipment or property that was not part of the real estate of the hotel, even though the owner was the same. hotel.
Okay.
So there's no fear that we're involved in any foreclosure action against any hotel. Well, that's not true because there's two hotels on them. There's another hotel that I'm thinking of. I really don't want to speak of them out loud. And,
okay.
Yeah. I'm thinking of one that was on the list because of a piece of equipment. Another one is it's in the name of a nonprofit or LLC, and it is on the list for foreclosure.
Okay.
But be that as it may, I had every assurance from that particular group that they were going to pay before the redemption period is over. So, you know, it's tough times,
you know,
for sure, on anyone in this industry.
And then I guess my other two questions or comments, whenever we look at the plans for the students to return, some of the plans that I've seen include not having the parents come with the students. And has that been factored in? Because I know that returning weekend is a massive weekend for our hotels. And if the parents aren't coming with the students, then we're not going to be getting that revenue.
I think it's more what Jason was saying. They've used different scenarios to forecast how we get through the rest of this year and next year. I'll let Jason speak to it, but I don't know if they picked the most severe one or the middle one. I'm not sure how they came down.
I think that's all part of what happens over the next few weeks may determine what scenario is more likely to come about. It'll also, I will say, some of the scenarios that we put our planning department put together did assume perhaps a net loss of rooms, assuming that some hotels may not survive this. That will play more, I think, into the 2021 discussion. But, you know, right now, second quarter results were pretty devastating. We expected that, too. Keep in mind, some of the hotels did close for the month of April and beyond, so I think it was expected. But this is all, depending on what happens with reopening, may change a little bit of this projecting forward. We just don't know right now.
Yeah, and I think, you know, just my third point was that if, in fact, students need to be quarantined and we're putting – or the universities are putting them up in hotels, then that would not – we would not receive any taxes for that if it was under the university's bill. Is that correct?
I'm sorry. Say that one more time. I'm sorry. I didn't get quite big at all that.
Yeah, no. If the universities, if there were six students or if they needed to be quarantined, the university – let's just say – a university needed to put them up in a hotel, they're non-taxable, and so we would not receive hotel tax for their stays.
I believe so, yes.
Okay. Not that we want to generate – I'm not saying that we want to generate tax revenue from sick people. That's – don't misinterpret that, please.
I understand what you're asking.
Thank you for that clarification, Shauna. Tomorrow's headlines, Martha and then Annie.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask that, too, but I think I would say – they're going to quarantine students while they're waiting for their tests. So we're going to assume none of them is sick, and that's so.
Quarantine the healthy. You isolate the sick, right, Frank? Frank's not off yet.
Yeah. A couple questions, Rick. I'm looking at your report, and is there a delay in the calculation of the quarter like there is with sales tax? In other words, is the first quarter – actually, January to March, or is it December to February?
Yeah, very good question. The first quarter represents December through February, and then they have the month of March to pay, and then we have our, like, due date, which is first week of April. So there's that much of a delay. So our second quarter now, which we just reported out tonight, would be March, April, and May. And then they have the month of June to report. And they're actually late now in the first week of July. So that's how much of a lag there is.
Okay, so the first quarter is entirely before the pandemic. The second quarter includes like 2 weeks before our emergency declaration. But mostly it's during the declaration. What about short-term rentals? And I think they're still operating, and are they paying?
I do have another report. I didn't share it, and that breaks it down into bed and breakfast and short-term rentals. And
let me look at it here. It's
can we get that report sent, and then we can get that information probably next month, since none of us will see it right now?
It's just one number I can give you. $3,000 out of the $113,000 for the second quarter, just $3,000 was from bed and breakfast or rooms less than 11 rooms. So the other $110,000 was from the hotels. Only $3,000, less than that really, $2,954 was from bed and breakfast.
And that includes the short-term rentals, the Airbnb. Is that right?
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, Annie?
Thank you. I was going to ask the same question Martha had, but now I have, as far as the timing of what the actual quarter is, but now that you've explained that, I guess I'm not understanding why we were down a third in our room tax if that quarter was truly before the pandemic, but maybe so, I mean, we're down a third from last year, so do we have a reason for that?
I can speak a little bit to it. I think there are several. It's more of a more in-depth conversation, but I do think that if you look at your prior several quarters before that, you'll see that there's a continual trend that the quarter in the prior year is greater. I think you're starting to see some more. In general, over the years, you've seen some accelerated replacement, I think, of hotel rooms by Airbnbs and by some of the short-term rentals. And I do think the short-term rentals are growing in terms of proportion of total revenue from hotel tax. And if you recall, there's a lesser percentage charge for short-term rentals, which is also generally usually a lower cost too, in terms of rentals. So I think that's part of the reason on why you're starting to see some of the prior quarters, even pre-COVID, showing lower numbers than they were in the prior quarters before that, prior years. That's part of, I think, some of the explanation. I think there's probably a much more in-depth conversation to have with some of the hotelers as well as Nick and from our planning department, but that's some of the explanation.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, so maybe maybe at HED or some other time to talk about, I mean, that's just a huge decline in one quarter. Thank you.
All right. We're going on, folks. Henry, and then Anna, you have the last word, and then we got to move on.
Yes. Shauna, one of the plans of Cornell is they're going to move in sequence, and I know they're going to test them when they get there. And so they're not going to be allowed on campus until their test comes back negative. So, in fact, it could be a real boon for the hotels. And so that is one plan they have, where they want to move in 8,000 people over like a week period. So.
Thank you, Henry. Anna.
So a boon for the hotels, but not necessarily tax, but the hotels definitely need it. The other comment that I had was Airbnb. I just wanted to remind everyone that the room tax is automatically collected. That is an agreement with Airbnb, and so I don't know if we have it with the other ones. I think we do. I'm not sure, Jason, so that was one question, but I know it's Airbnb. And the other thing I wanted to remind people of is that the short-term rentals, we collect 3% from them and 5% from the hotels. There's no other county in the state that does that. That was our local choice. So that can be revisited by us. So I just wanted to remind people of that.
Okay. Thank you very much. Rick, is there anything else?
No, that completes my report. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We have a couple of staff people who are waiting, so I want to take the consent agenda before we consider a break, or we can finish this whole thing tonight. Look at that. Are there any resolutions to be added or withdrawn from the agenda? Are you with? Yes, Martha.
Yeah, I have the one that was sent, that Kathy sent today, and yesterday to legislators. It is when we get there. ID 9426, Resolution G, resolution urging the federal government to provide urgently needed aid for states and local governments.
All right, so to be added to the agenda, so Mike, are you seconding?
Yes.
Seconded by Mike Lane. We need 10 votes to add it to the agenda. Roll call.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Foreman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Sean Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Clairborn?
Yes.
13 ayes, 0 noes.
Right, so that's added to the agenda. Any others to be withdrawn or added? No. Thank you very much. Let's move on to the consent agenda. These are resolutions, and we've already done the appointments to be voted on as a group, unless any member of the legislature requests that a resolution be instead included separately individually as part of the business, outstanding, or special committee. And I will read those resolutions. On the Housing and Economic Development Committee, Resolution A, authorizing 2020 coronavirus aid, relief and economic recovery, that's the CARES Act, Federal Transit Administration Section 5307 grant application for TCAT, Tompkins Consolidated Area Transit, Gadabout, and Tompkins County. ID 9418. Next, on the Facilities and Infrastructure, Resolution B, award of bid PIN 3756.18, Ludlowville Road, County Route 159 bridge replacement with a BIN number of 3314350, Town of Lansing, ID 9397. Resolution C, authorization to execute contract with Fisher Associates for construction phase services for PIN 3756.18, Ludlowville Road, bridge replacement, again, Town of Lansing, ID 9399. Resolution D, approve supplemental agreement number 2 with New York State Department of Transportation for PIN 3756.33, replacement of Etna Lane Bridge over Fall Creek, BIN 3314180, Town of Dryden, ID 9390. Resolution E, audit.
I'd like to pull that.
Pull Resolution E.
Yes, please. Thank you.
Thank you. Under Government Operations, Resolution F, resolution to update the administrative policy manual, policy 0321, telework arrangements, and policy 0322, flexible work schedules, ID 94112.
Would the revised policies being distributed?
The revised policy was distributed. Got it. May I have somebody move the consent agenda, please? Moved by Deborah, seconded by Dave McKenna. Roll call, all in favor of consent agenda.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis? Yes. Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Foreman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Arthur Robertson?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Clairborn?
Yes.
13 ayes, 0 noes.
Thank you very much. Thank you, staff, for hanging in there. We are going to take a quick break. It's 7:33. Be back here at 7:40. And we'll bang the rest of this out and be home by 8 o'clock. Look at that. We are back, and there's Glenn. Thank you. We're going to move on into our standing and special committee reports. Folks, I just want to alert you to the fact that it is very cold in here. Very soon I won't be able to feel my fingers. So if you will please move it along nicely. Actually, yeah, why don't I go with, Mike is still here? Yes, he is. Bear with me. Facilities and infrastructure, Resolution E was pulled from the consent agenda. So, Mike Lane, do you want to take your facilities and infrastructure report in resolution so Mike Hall can go home?
Yes, and I want to thank Mike for being with us tonight. I knew there were questions about this particular resolution, some of the figures from some of the legislators. So I would like to go ahead and move that. It's the audit of final payment, E.L. James, Inc., DBA RJ, Ortlieb Construction Co., for the passenger boarding bridge, gate number 3, Ithaca-Tompkins Regional Airport, and I so move.
We have a second, second by Glenn Morey. Discussion, Martha, you pulled it from the agenda.
Yeah, thanks, Leslie. Thanks, Mike and Mike. I'm just having trouble with the memo and the resolution. None of the numbers match. And in other words, the memo says approval of resolution to make the final payment of $26,000, and the resolution is a resolution for $359,000. So I'm not sure where the math is.
Well, I can tell you what happened with the bridge. The bridge was under contract as a longer bridge, and then when we expanded the terminal, the bridge was shortened by about a third, reducing the cost of the bridge. And I think that explains the numbers. I don't have in front of me exactly what you've got in front of you, but that's how it worked out, is that we wound up paying less for the bridge because we built the terminal behind it, if you will.
Well, that says, so the that's explained in the memo, bringing it from $68,000 in the original contract to $532,000 and change. But the resolution is for $358,000. And the memo says, talks about the final payment of $26,000. I mean, I'm all for it. I just want to understand the numbers. Where's $358,000 come from? Is that a percentage?
Or is the $358,000 the total cost and the $26,000 is just the final payment?
I believe that's correct, Leslie.
Yes, I think that's the way it is.
So we got a reduction cost on the bridge, and then that smaller number is the final payment for them.
Well, but this authorizes finance to pay the large number. I guess I don't know. Have we not paid any, and this is the total, and it's time to pay the whole thing, or final?
I can't answer that. I wasn't sure what the question was this evening, but I can't answer that with the information I have in front of me. But we could certainly get an answer for it.
Does Rick know?
Rick, are you still on?
Yeah. That's me again. On the jet bridge, the final payment?
Yeah, so they're wondering why the resolution is for the 300 and some thousand, final payment is 26.
Because that's how we bring final payments to you. Like on a bridge or road, or any capital project, the committee sees the draws as the project commences and goes through the period, but it's the legislature that sees the final draw or the final payment.
Does that mean the total payment? Not just the final payment, but the total payment?
No, the final payment.
So, Rick, here's what's going on here. The resolution has an amount of $358,000 and change, $950. Is what the resolution says, and it's for a final payment. The memo that came with it said the approval of the resolution to make a final payment of $26,600 and something. So those two numbers don't match. So we're asking, is the $358 the total cost of the bridge and not just the final payment?
That's just the final payment. I could look up the total cost. Mike, you don't have the total cost there?
I wasn't sure what the question was going into this, so I don't have the total cost in front of me, but I'm going to say that it was closer to $1 million to refurbish the bridge.
Okay.
Is this time sensitive?
Yeah, I would say anything with the airport is pretty much. I'm looking up the project on a trail.
We should have the file there on the project, and I think we can untangle this.
Do you understand my problem? The $358 is not justified anywhere in the memo. That's not the number that's given as the.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
And so, I don't know if it has to do with the percentage based on the state percentage and the airport percentage, et cetera. That's not explained.
So can I stick a nail in this one while Rick looks it up and gets information that we can move to another committee and then come back as soon as he has an answer for us? Is that okay?
Yeah, I'll be back with an answer in a minute.
Thank you.
All right, so let's hold on to this one. We'll come back to it. Mike, any other thing for you to report on, and then we can just deal with your resolution?
Well, we had our regular meeting, and we heard from several departments. One thing, Leslin, we're still waiting to hear from you as to when we can schedule the presentation by Jeff Smith to the full legislature, a small presentation about our highway program. He's ready to go and will have a few maps and slides to show us. Whether we can do that next meeting or whenever, that would be up to you as chair. So if you could please let us know that. We had a report from Barbara Ekstrom and the Solid Waste Department. I thought it was kind of an interesting discussion about the contamination of our recycling and how we compare statewide and nationally, for example, about the contamination, what efforts we've been going through to warn people. The next stages are going to be more serious, not taking the recycling, for example, not just leaving notes saying you got to do better. But what was really interesting to me was the program that they did to survey the recycling. They chose 5 routes and brought in the actual recycling to the center and went through it manually on the line to see what was in the recycling loads. And the percentage of contamination any contamination is not great, but it was not above the state and local and national averages. So our recycling is cleaner. We ask about, for example, was there a difference between routes? So was a student route, for example, with a lot of students on it, did that have more contamination? And the answer was no. They were about the same. There were rural routes and there were city routes. I thought it was kind of an innovative way of looking at this, and we are going to continue to try to do better with our recycling, but we're starting from a pretty good position already, and that helps us sell the recycling better than many of the other places that have much dirtier, contaminated recycling. We also had a report from Arel Lamaro about his work since the COVID crisis has begun with his department, the facilities department. He's been staff there needs to be commended because of all the extra work they've been doing, especially with some of the staff being furloughed. They are still continuing with some of the capital projects that they've had scheduled, including working toward the repaving of the health department block, for example. Highway, I mentioned before, and the good thing about the Ludlowville Bridge resolutions, which you saw tonight, is that when the bid has now been awarded by us, the contractor will be moving forward that Silver Line, and they expect in discussions that this bridge will actually be done before the state needs to close the big bridge on State Route 34.
That's good.
And so that's something that's been a big topic of conversation at the ITCTC, Ithaca Tompkins Transportation Council, because the state really would like to see this bridge available for the detour rather than to have to go down through Myers or somewhere else. So that was a bit of good news.
Yeah.
Ann, did I miss anything?
I think that pretty much covered it. I would just add that, of course, you might have mentioned this, but there was we saved quite a bit of money by keeping our recycling as clean as possible. So before, I think a few years ago, they used to say, well, if you think it can be recycled, go ahead and put it in. But nowadays, they're saying it's such a difference in the price that please make sure that it's recyclable. Check the numbers on things, if it's plastic, for instance, and not contaminated pizza boxes with any food scraps. Clean everything that you put in, or you need to throw it in the garbage. So thank you.
That's a good point, Ann. And when we say contamination, it's not just food scraps, for example, in with the recycling. It's the wrong kind of plastic in with the recycling, for example.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks, Annie. And while I'm at it, I was just conferring with Kathy. And Mike, Jeff certainly can come to the next legislature meeting if he's ready to go with his presentation, as you said. That would be fine.
Thank you. We'll get the word out.
Communicate that to him. Thank you. Moving on, let's go back to the top of the agenda with budget. Capital Personnel Committee, Martha.
Thank you, Leslyn. We had an expanded budget committee meeting, as Jason mentioned, last Tuesday, June 30th. I really appreciate everybody's time in coming and spending the time to hear the updates from Jason, the staff, and the thoughtful conversation about everybody's priorities, which kind of, I'd sum it up with, let's keep doing everything we're doing, you know, just somehow try to be able to afford it. Budget next meeting is Monday at 3 o'clock. That is July 13th. And we will be talking with Dominic Recchio about how to talk about what kind of public outreach might be possible about the budget coming up, and also taking some time to talk about what a reasonable schedule might be, what the right format for our expanded budget meetings in September and October. So we'll try to chew that around on Monday, as well as the usual topics that will come up. So that's.
Thank you, Martha. Any questions to Martha?
Yep.
All right.
Thank you.
We'll keep doing what we're doing. WDIC, Ann Coleman, Chair. Oof, it's cold.
Thank you, Leslyn. So I'll try and do this quick so you don't have to get up and do jumping jacks. So we had a presentation at our last meeting from the Ithaca Asian American Association. And if you haven't got a chance, please look at our video. It was quite illuminating to hear about the discrimination that's going on, and including rising to the level of assaults on our Ithaca Asian American community. So please take a look at that. We're going to have them return to the next meeting because we got into brainstorming to try and figure out, because their main ask was, do you have any ideas for us of what to do? Because they're just not sure what to do. And so we're going to continue that at the next meeting, and we're inviting the Common Council, the Ithaca Common Council Diversity Committee to also meet remotely with us. So please check that out and tune in our next meeting. I believe, let me go back and check, July 22nd at 3:30. Thank you.
And you said you're inviting the city's Workforce Diversity Advisory Committee to join you at that meeting?
Yes.
Okay. Any questions for Annie? No? Thank you very much, Annie. Tiger Committee.
Thank you, Leslin. Thank you very much. We met on July 1st and had a robust discussion with Ryan Gregoire from NYSAC. He did a great summary of the bills that had been just passed from at the end of the legislative session in Albany. And his basically similar presentation is available. NYSAC has a webinar describing all of those all those bills and updates from Albany. If you go to your NYSAC action alert or update that we get every day or so. But it was a great chance to ask him questions as well. We also were able to have Charlie Krasansky and Diane Miller from Cornell, and had a good discussion in particular about, and this was with Ryan especially, about kind of the best of the federal bills when we're trying to still talk about federal aid to state and local governments. And that's the basis of the resolution that we've added to the agenda. But to be really brief, it's Direct Support for Communities Act. It's got a House number, H.R. 6748, is what NACO, the National Association for Counties, and NYSAC are really pushing. That seems to be a solid compromise. They're trying to get bipartisan support for that. I didn't put that into the resolution that's in front of you. Just, we thought it was best if we kind of made the substantive points, the content points we wanted without naming a particular piece of legislation. So, and I guess the Kathy question is now the time I should bring that resolution up?
Number five. You already have a motion on the table that we have to deal with first. Resolution E is still on the table.
Okay, we're waiting for
that dollar, that resolution.
Okay, all right. Well, I'll just to finish my report, the next, whenever you say it's time to do it,
Okay.
The next Tiger meeting is August 5th. 11:30, and so far I've confirmed Sarah Clark, who is one of the regional representatives for Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, so she'll be able to join us that day. And stay tuned. Maybe by August 5th we can be all excited about the federal aid bill that passed and something else.
Woo-hoo. Thank you, Martha. Any questions for Martha? Or we'll get to the Member 5 resolution later. All right. Housing Economic Development Committee. Anna Kellis, chair.
Great. Thank you. We met last month, the end of the month, on the 25th. And one of the highlights was a presentation from Kurt Anderson on the local economic impacts of coronavirus. He is doing work. He works at TCAD. Two things. One that I thought was very interesting is that the economic impact of this crisis is much steeper as a curve than we have seen in previous crises, economic crises like 2018, There is, however, from the research that he has done, reading reports and studies by economists throughout the country, that it's expected to bounce back a lot faster, which was a bit of a relief to hear that at least that's a prediction. It is recorded. I highly recommend that people, if they want details, to watch it. Leslin, he also offered to give a presentation to the full legislature. So if that's something that the entire legislature would like, I found it very valuable. I think others on the committee did as well. So I'm happy to organize that. And we have a meeting coming up on the 23rd of July at 9:30. This one will be focused on tourism. We'll be getting updates after the second quarter data. Also questions that have been asked of ACOD organizations. We may get some preliminary data. If not, then we'll get it the following month. But that conversation is continuing. And obviously we'll have the discussion of adjustments to tourism funding. That preliminary discussion and actions that may need to be taken will also begin in that meeting. So that is at 9:30 a.m. on the 23rd, and that's my full report.
Thank you, Anna. Any questions for Anna? All right. Thank you all very much. You're being very kind to me. Complete Census Count Committee. Somebody have a question?
Rick might be ready.
Huh?
Kind of looks like Rick's ready.
Oh, thank you. I'm so glad you're here, Dan. Can you see that?
I'm ready to try to help. Press the boarding bridge.
All right, Mike. So let's go back to Mike Lane's committee, Facilities and Infrastructure. Go ahead.
I add up all the payments for the project, and what's in the memorandum is correct. The amount that's outstanding, that's retainage, is $26,637.75. That's in the memorandum. That same number should be plugged into the resolution instead of the 358,000 number. It should read $6,637.75. So if we could input that change.
That amendment is friendly.
Friendly to the seconder as well, Glenn?
Yes.
All right.
Thank you to Martha for pointing that out so we get it right.
Thank you.
All right. So now let's take that resolution up. Do you have a question, Martha? Continue.
Yeah, Rick, your audio is really spotty. You said that the $26,637.75 should be in the resolution. Is that what you said?
Yes, correct.
Okay, thank you. And Leslin, I'm sorry, you're making us really feel jealous here of folks who don't have air conditioning. So, just saying.
Girl, there's no jealousy here. I will trade with you in a heartbeat. My clothes are about to fall off right about now.
It's about to fall off. Thanks to Rick and Drew for figuring that out. Appreciate it.
All right. So the amended resolution is on the floor. It was moved and seconded and friendly. Let's have a roll call vote on it.
Rich Jan?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
David McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Grandison?
Yes.
Leslin B. Claiborne?
Yes.
13 ayes, 0 no.
That carries unanimously. Thank you all very much for your patience on it. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Mike Hall. And Rick for getting the numbers right. Okay, moving on. Downtown Facilities Committee.
Oh, you missed the census.
Who did I miss? Complete Census Count Committee.
Yeah, we got
Mike.
Sent back to the other one, so that's all right. But I'll give you a brief report. We met on Monday. Again, I want to compliment all the groups that come to our meeting in addition to our great committee members. We continue to talk about the student undercount, particularly with respect to the off-campus students in the housing. There's still discussion at the congressional level about having the possibility of hearings to rectify this problem for the many, many college communities across the country. It's been suggested to us that we write a letter to the state director of the census and also the federal census and request that they take action on this. So that's one of the things we'll probably be drafting a letter, hopefully at the end of this week. Speaking of letters, we did send a letter to the three college presidents, Orinthia Montague at TC3, Shirley Collado at the college, and Martha Pollack at Cornell University, letter under Leslin's signature and my signature and Jason Molino's signature, requesting their continued help in and redoubling of effort to try to get a better count of their student populations, recognizing the COVID problems, but knowing how the 10-year problem will be with us if we don't get better count. There are census workers out there now. We were told by Michael Blinkelair, one of our census specialists, that they're beginning to follow up on residences, for example, that have not submitted their questionnaires at this point. I want to thank particularly Nick Murphy and Amy Hendrick for putting together a budget, working with our Public Information Advisory Board to have some funding, to have a funding request from our contingent fund to do things to try to, from here on out, to try to advertise. It isn't anywhere near the $130,000 that we were praying to get from New York State. One more broken promise, of course. But it will be about $10,000. It will include things like everything from lawn signs to social media ads, TCAT bus ads, radio spots, or other advertising such as that. So you'll be seeing that. That was passed by the Census Committee, and I assume it'll go to budget and then to this legislature, hopefully next meeting, to be able to do that. I really think we've been having pretty good cooperation, very good cooperation from our colleges, particularly Cornell and IC. They understand the problem, too. That's pretty much what we talked about. Amanda, was there anything I missed? Okay.
All right. Thank you very much, Mike. We keep plugging along. Downtown facilities, Dave, anything?
No, sorry to say we have not met since the last meeting, and I have already canceled the one for July, so nothing going on currently.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Public Safety Committee, Rich John, Chair.
Oh.
I'm sorry, Mike, did you say something?
Yeah, there's something on the census I had intended to bring up, and may I go back to it at whatever point you feel is proper?
Why don't you go ahead right now before Rich starts?
I'm sorry, I did want to mention in census we did talk about the redistricting issue. And the understanding of the problems we may have encountering, we may be encountering if we do not have, if we do not go forward with the change of our terms and the different redistricting. And one of the issues that had come up, in this process was, you know, what if the city does something and we don't do that? And I asked Greg Potter, I don't think there's anybody that has more experience with these kinds of things than Greg in his service in at least two senses. And I wonder if I could just ask Greg what we have to watch out for if we go ahead that way. Greg? I wonder if you could speak up to that.
Sure. I had been involved in the last two redistricting projects, and one of the priorities for both of those groups has always been the try to work with the city to collocate as much as possible the boundaries of the city wards with the city legislators. And so that has been done at the same time in both those projects. So if we're on a different schedule in the future, then it's a greater possibility that those boundaries may not match as well as they have in the past, which is going to result in sliver districts, which is an issue for both the residents and for the Board of Elections.
Greg, could you explain what a sliver district is?
Yeah, so there are smaller areas of overlapping boundaries between the city wards and the county legislative districts. So it's very difficult in the best of circumstances to have those boundaries match. And that has been done the last two redistricting efforts with a lot of back and forth in timing between the city and the county as one of the priorities for both of those groups.
And so, for example, a sliver district, what happens? That's an election district, right?
Yeah, the Board of Elections would have to generate a separate ballot in certain conditions if the city's ballot initiatives differ between the counties.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Henry, did you have a question?
Yeah. Don't we, since there's only four county representatives and five wards for the city, isn't that what we have now?
There in effect are four legislative districts in the city of Ithaca, and right. They're pretty much contiguous with the city boundaries, except for one exception. And there's only two small sliver districts in the city that cross between the city wards and the existing legislative districts where there's a difference.
So we have sliver districts now.
Yeah, just a few of them.
Okay.
But it's really difficult to even come up with a solution to minimize it down to those. We spent a lot of time working on that with the city in the last redistricting project.
But during the last redistricting project, how come you didn't match them up?
It was statistically impossible.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Anything else, Mike from Census? So that was the last.
Thank you for letting me add that. I did want to make sure people heard that.
Okay. Thank you very much. Next committee, Rich John.
Les, I'm sorry. I had my hand up. Leslie?
Oh.
So if I can just follow up, Greg, so the city might go ahead. We don't know, and the city might go ahead and redistrict sooner than we would. And so then, is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So once the census data is published, if the city decides to go ahead and redistrict, they can reorganize their ward boundaries ahead of the county based on the current configuration. If they do so and the county comes back and redistricts, then we have we have some decisions to make about our own boundaries outside of what the city has done.
So in other words,
all right, it seems like this is going into a redistricting conversation more than the census committee, and I'm being a little weary about this.
I was trying to understand that mechanics. I'm not on the census committee or whatever, so.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
Did you have a question, Dan? Okay. Thank you. Public safety, Rich John. Thank you, Rich, for your patience.
No problem at all. Thank you. The public safety committee met in June, and I had a couple issues I'd like to just report out on. The first was some, I thought, really good community news. The and I want to make sure I get the names right. Brian Robeson from our Department of Emergency Response has been working with the Tompkins County Amateur Radio Association. And a little trivia, they started in the 1950s as the Ithaca Mike and Key Club. But if anybody's done the Ride for Life, the bicycle ride around the lake, or any of the triathlons or big events, the Tompkins County Radio Amateur Radio Association really helps out with providing on-the-ground communications throughout the venue. So they're, say, they're all around the lake, making sure that all the riders are accounted for and safe. They've been working with our Department of Emergency Response for quite a while, and to form a radio amateur civil emergency service races group, which is a backup to our 911 system using radios, ham radios. And this is just a really good redundancy to have. It's a very cost-effective way to do it. It uses the various locations around the county, generally fire stations, to, in very short order, set up a parallel pathway for radio communications for emergencies around the county. And I wanted to commend the group for all the work they've done on it and just the foresight. Hopefully, we'll never need it, but it's really good to know it's there, especially if we have an extreme weather event that knocks out our existing system. And they did point out this has happened in a lot of communities, and having the resiliency is a really smart thing. So thank you. The other thing we had a report from Heather Campbell from the Advocacy Center. Because of COVID and the stay-at-home orders, we've been quite concerned about what's been happening with domestic violence. Certainly people are under a lot of stress, or have been, and they've been isolated. And so we had a really informative talk from Heather coming in and sharing with us the challenges that we've had. We have seen some increase in domestic violence calls in the past few months. And, you know, this is truly unfortunate. And she talked about all the steps they've been taking to try to make sure they're maintaining and establishing communications in a very tough environment, and also operate a shelter. She also indicated that because New York State reimburses on use of shelter beds, and because of fear of the virus and isolation, the shelter population for domestic violence victims has been down, and so they've suffered a revenue shortfall as a result. Hopefully, this is stabilizing as we slowly reopen. But it was a really informative talk. The only other thing I'd say is we're going to meet on July 16th at 3 o'clock. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Rich. Questions for Rich? Shauna?
I just wanted to ask where we are in thinking about moving forward with the new, either remodel or purchasing a new jail. Is that on hold for the time being?
Well, we have started that discussion, and the difficulty is that without having a fairly good sense of our budget situation, we might spend a ton of time on it and really get nowhere. Part of our discussion, and this makes it a little bit more difficult, was whether there were stopgap or interim measures we could take that would significantly improve the function of the existing facility. And the answer essentially was not really. You know, there's maybe some movable equipment for the kitchen or some other things, but the fundamental systemic structures in the jail, you either have to do a big fix or start over. So while we're going to continue to talk about it and we're going to try to flesh out issues, this is going to be a longer-term process because of the financial situation we're in. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rich. Any other questions?
I just had one other thing. I was going to mention that the governor has set up a commission system on a county-by-county basis to talk about police practices, and I anticipate county administration will be talking to us about that issue at our next meeting.
Okay. Thank you, Rich. Moving on to Health and Human Services Committee, Shauna Black, Chair.
Thank you very much, Leslin. We have not met since our last legislature meeting. Our upcoming meeting will be Monday, July 20th, and Sue Del Hall is going to join us and talk about child care. We're hoping that there will be some more guidance for the fall on child care and after school. I think many people, myself included, are trying to figure out what the fall looks like as far as if kids are going back to school, if there's going to be child care and after school programs available. And hopefully by the middle of July, we might have some answers. I was also thinking about seeing if someone from the school district might be able to come in and at least, have the conversation with us as well. I know that they're in the process, the school board's in the process of talking through their plans for the fall. And it would be nice to really hear what they're thinking or if they figured things out by that July meeting. So everyone is welcome to come. If there are any questions that you have prior to that and you aren't able to make the meeting, please let me know, and I'm happy to find out some answers for you.
Thank you, Shauna. Any questions? No, thank you all very much. Whew. Government Operations Committee, Amanda Champion Chair.
Thank you, Leslin. My house is very hot right now, so I wish I was in the air conditioning. This room is, anyway. So Government Operations met about a week ago, last week, I think. And the main focus of our meeting was the first discussion about a revision of the rules of the legislature document. We have a small committee made up of Rich and Dan and I who had started doing some editing on the first couple rules. I think we took the first four rules and we edited a document and got together. Then GO went through it and got some more feedback. And Rich and Dan and I actually met today to take those edits and go through them one more time. So that will be coming back to GO. That first chunk of rules will be coming back to GO at our next meeting, which is at the beginning of August. I'm not sure what the date is, but we'll find out. So that's kind of the main thing that we've been working on. We will be consulting with Jonathan and Kathy about making sure any changes that we want to make will align with what the charter says. Again, this is something that GO has been talking about, will continue to talk about, and any changes that the committee wants to make will come before the full legislature for everyone to vote on, just like all of the other policies that Lisa brings forward to us. And so that's kind of the first step. We're also our super subcommittee, Dan and Rich and I, are talking about getting started on the next chunk of it as well. So we're going to kind of see how far we can go a little bit at a time and look forward to more discussion on that in August. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Amanda. Questions for Amanda? Martha?
I have not a question. So thank you that Mike and I think Annie and I aren't committee members, but we participated in the discussion, and it was great to be able to just kind of all be in the conversation together. So I really appreciated that.
Thank you, and thanks for sharing the documents as well and the thoughts and the changes. So, others get to see and weigh in and so on before
you know, there's a vote and people are seeing it for the first time. So thank you for that.
Yep.
Anybody else? All right. Where am I now? Planning, Energy, and Environmental Quality Committee, Deborah Dawson, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We had a very informative meeting. We had a report about the fleet review and analysis report, and we also had a report from Irene Weiser on Public Service Commission hijinks. It was very informative and very dense, and in the interest of not freezing out our chair, I invite you, if you're interested in knowing what's going on with the NYSEG rate case and energy matters generally, to tune into the video of the meeting. Irene's presentation was at the end, probably the last half an hour or so, and we will not meet again until the 27th. Thank you.
July 27th. Any questions for Deborah? Thank you, Deborah. And now we're down to member filed resolution. Martha, you have the one that was added to the agenda. Go ahead, move.
All right, thank you. I would move up strong one. Resolution G, ID 9426, resolution urging the federal government to provide urgently needed aid for states and local governments. And so moved.
I have a second, please. Seconded by Deb Dawson. Discussion.
Yeah, and if I can say, Tiger did talk about this. We've talked about it like every meeting pretty much, and at that time, at the meeting last week, we heard that it was really, really pressing time. Like the middle of July, they really think apparently there are a lot of negotiations going on right now, and this was the time to really get our voice in there. So that's why we didn't have a resolution in time for the committee, but picked up on the information that we got at the meeting. And I wrote the attack. I wrote what you see here. So I hope we get into a cycle where we're not doing member filed after every Tiger meeting. But so far, it kind of has turned out that way. And I guess I would say the main content issue here is that we are asking that this is the second resolve that it be that the next COVID bill should include substantial direct unrestricted aid to state and local governments based on population, cumulative COVID-19 impacts since the beginning of the pandemic, and lost revenue due to the recession. That really is the sort of hits all the different impacts that are relevant, and we hope that the Senate can get behind that.
Thank you, Martha. Thank you for pushing that along. Rich?
I just want to say thank you, Martha, for your work on this, and also just to comment that Ryan Gregoire's presentation was really helpful in explaining some of what is swirling around in Albany and Washington. So thank you.
Anyone else? No, I know that at a meeting at which Congress, I just blanked on you. Not Congress, Senator Schumer, also, you know, spoke to this and was hopeful that, you know, the COVID-4, I think is what it's called, so whatever it is, bill might include something, and they'll keep pushing for it. So, you know, we need to keep the pressure on. So thank you. All right, if there are no other questions, roll call vote.
Rich Jen?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corbin?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
John Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Grandison?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Clairborn?
Yes.
13 ayes, 0 noes.
That carries unanimously. Thank you all so very much. Thanks again, Martha, for drafting the resolution, and Tiger for talking about it. Minutes of the previous meeting. Moved by Dan Klein, seconded by Ann Corman. Any corrections or additions or anything to the minutes? All right. Vote on the minutes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Anna Kellis?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Arthur Robertson?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Henry Grandison?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Clairborn?
Yes.
13 ayes, 0 noes.
Thank you very much for that. Under unfinished business, as Jonathan had indicated to us, this is the place that we that I'm asking if there's anyone who would like to move for reconsideration the resolution from GO at our last meeting regarding legislative term limits. And this have anybody who voted in the prevailing side, I believe, which would be a no vote, someone who voted in a no vote, can ask for it to be reconsidered. You've heard a lot of or some conversation tonight about it. You heard some stuff from Jonathan. You saw the memo from Jonathan. We just heard from Greg and some of the discussion that happened at the Complete Census Count Committee. And I wonder if there's anyone who would like to move for reconsideration this resolution. Do I do my first ruler number? Anyone? Anyone? No? No one is interested in moving that. Thank you all for at least thinking about it. The other thing I want to quickly mention to you all is you might have read it, and Jason had sent this out. In terms of remote meetings, so the governor had extended his executive order through August 5th. In the meantime, you know, Kathy and I, you know, will be, you know, talking through, and Jim here, what we need to put in place in the event that it doesn't get extended any further. You know, we might have to do some hybrid to accommodate different needs. But we'll see how that goes. So thank you, Jason, for bringing it up in the control room. And thanks to the rest of you for us talking about it. Martha?
Thanks, Leslie. And since you brought up air conditioning tonight, there's a lot of news stories now about the questions about HVAC systems and spreading the virus around, special filters that might be available or needed. So I hope we're really looking into that for all of our buildings, but it's another consideration in terms of bringing the legislature back for meetings. So I just wanted to put a note on that in people's heads.
Thank you for raising that issue, Martha. Mike Lane?
I probably should have brought this up on privilege to the floor, but I just thought folks might be interested. Lee Shurtleff, who is retired from the county, used to be our director of emergency response. It was in the Cortland Standard here last week that one of the things he does is serve as the chief of the fire department in Groton, and he has now been elected as president of the New York State Fire Chiefs Association. So I think that's pretty pretty nice, and shows a lot of commitment statewide, and a lot of respect from the other fire chiefs.
Well, thank you. Congratulations to Lee. That's wonderful news. I'll take one more comment, and then we'll wrap this evening. Annie?
Thanks. I was just for Mike Lane and just wondering, and maybe for Jason too, if we can just add that to our next agenda for F&I, the topic that Martha mentioned, to talk about making the air a little safer, whether it's fresh air intake or special filters for legislature and other buildings.
Yeah. I know Arell did, I don't know if he sent a response out to all legislators. He did address some of this in terms of how they're starting circulation in facilities earlier, the level of a filter that they have and the proactive measures they've already taken well in advance, even before we started to bring folks back into the facilities. But we can definitely have them talk a little bit more about it if you'd like.
All right.
Certainly we can ask Pastor him to come in and speak to that.
Yeah, we had a lot of just so you know, this wasn't anything that hasn't come up. We had a lot of this conversation internally probably back in March, knowing that some people would still be in facilities. So it was something that we've talked about along with the whole, cleaning discussion, enhanced cleaning discussion in the facility. So it's something we've discussed, but I'm sure he can elaborate a little bit more on what actions they've taken and what they're doing.
Well, thank you all very much. Now that I know that the air is cranked up, I'll dress warmer next time in layers, like Dan, so I don't have to freeze. Thank you all very much for your time. Everyone have a great evening. Motion to adjourn. Moved by Anna Kellis, seconded by Amanda Champion. And we are all adjourned. Everyone in favor? Aye, all over the board. Everybody is hands up. Thank you all. We are adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.